In 2015, Boris Johnson, then the mayor of London, derided British supporters of BDS as corduroy jacketed, snaggle-toothed, lefty academics. Michael Gove, another high-profile conservative politician, said in 2016 that the campaign to boycott the fabricated regime of Israel was a crime worse than apartheid. Numerous human rights groups have since confirmed that the Zionist regime practices apartheid against the Palestinian population. Today, in Johnson's government, Gove will oversee Britain's fight against BDS. He will be shadowed in the Labour opposition by Lisa Nandy, who has previously spoken out against the boycott movement. Last week's announcement in the Queen's speech followed a parliamentary vote in February to ban boycott of the Zionist regime in public pension funds, severely curbing the rights of fund administrators to have their ethical views taken into account when investing. The Zionist propaganda routinely accuses BDS supporters of being anti-Semitic, a claim that has no basis when the movement's demands are examined. BDS calls for the implementation of basic Palestinian rights, including an end to the Israeli regime occupation, equal treatment for all citizens, and respecting the right of return for Palestinian refugees. These demands are not only legal and peaceful, but also ethical. The BDS movement does not pose any threat to Jewish communities around the world. The community cohesion argument does not hold water. How does a movement calling for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against a foreign state impact communities in the U.S.? The drive to implement an anti-boycott policy suggests that Britain will never hold the fabricated regime of Israel to account for its crimes, for fear it could upset the Jewish community in the U.S. It is worth noting here that members of the Jewish community hold different views on the Zionist regime, and many have a strong objections to Israel's apartheid policies and oppression of Palestinians. Indeed, the BDS movement should prompt members of Jewish communities who claim to have an affinity with the Zionist regime to question its recent appalling history and repeated violations of Palestinian rights, including through the 2018 nation-state law, which codifies superior rights for Jewish citizens and paves the way for further Zionist annexation of Palestinian land. Following on from the Queen's speech, the Conservatives appear committed to bringing an anti-BDS bill to Parliament soon. Yet, considering Britain's championing of sanctions against Moscow over the Russia-Ukraine tension, the government may find it challenging to land on wording that curtails boycotts of the fabricated regime of Israel while allowing them for other countries. Palestinian activists and other social justice campaigners have been aware that this was coming, and they have been organizing for some time. Last month, dozens of groups united to launch a website and issue a statement warning against the proposed legislation and calling on the government to back away from it. They labeled the partnership Right to Boycott. While last week's announcement makes clear that activists have not convinced the government to drop its anti-BDS quest, the focus now shifts to ensuring the related law does not pass. Parliamentarians across party lines will need to do much soul-searching in the coming days, asking themselves whether curtailing democratic rights is a fair price to pay for maintaining political relations with the Zionist regime. Holding a massive majority in Parliament, the British government can potentially pass any legislation it chooses unless there is a backbench rebellion. In this case, such a rebellion could be triggered by the legitimate fear that the anti-boycott bill would further erode democratic rights in the UK. British MPs should stand on the right side of history and not only defeat this bill, but financially put an end to the double standards when it comes to the Palestinian people and ensure that the Zionist regime is held accountable for its crimes.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly program that will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities and most importantly, the people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the worst economic and political crisis faced by the island nation of Sri Lanka, a crisis rooted in fiscal mismanagement by successive governments. And we shall also take a look at growing relations between regional powers India and Japan and the factors that have bolstered their strategically driven relationship.
Sri Lanka, a small island nation located off the southern coast of India, is grappling with its biggest economic meltdown, which has fueled the political crisis and violent protests, the worst the country has seen since its independence in 1948. What began as peaceful demonstrations in late February over soaring inflation, shortage of food and fuel and power outages have gradually morphed into a countrywide uprising. Amid the unprecedented turmoil, the sitting premier has forced to resign, but the president continues to hold the fort.
Violence in the island country erupted after a month of peaceful demonstrations over the dire economic situation that has affected all sections of Sri Lankan society. Lengthy blackouts, record inflation and shortage of food and medicine forced people into the streets against the family-run government. To foil the popular agitation, a nationwide curfew was imposed and the military was heavily deployed, but not before 9 people were killed and over 225 were wounded. The unrest and violence in the last 2 weeks is the worst the island country has seen since the 2019 Easter bombing. Angry protesters who have been demanding the ouster of President Gotabaya Rajapaksa have been attacked by pro-government mobs. Earlier, the president's brother and prime minister, Mahinda Rajapaksa, resigned under public pressure and fled to a notorious torture camp in the Tamil-majority region northeast. He was replaced by Ranil Wickremesinghe, a seasoned politician who has in the past been accused of facilitating corruption and fanning the long-standing ethnic conflict. The crisis in the country of 22 million is rooted in economic mismanagement by successive governments. The country has now been forced to turn to the International Monetary Fund for aid after months of denial. But that seems insufficient to pacify protesters who want a complete political shake-up, including the resignation of President Rajapaksa.
While the unprecedented economic crisis threatens to upend the nation of 22 million people, it has also caused the staggering fall of the country's most powerful political dynasty. The Rajapaksa family dominated Sri Lanka's political scene for almost 2 decades. The family's dramatic collapse was triggered by an economic crisis caused by decades of fiscal mismanagement and aggravated by populist policies. The stress eventually led to a crash. Now, most of the family members are in hiding, except the embattled president himself.
Early murmurs of the unrest were heard in late February, But it was not until early April that peaceful protests gained momentum across the small island country. The key demand raised by protesters was the resignations of the two powerful brothers, the president and prime minister. When his supporters attacked anti-government protesters, sparking clashes across the country, Prime Minister Mahinda Rajapaksa was forced to resign. He soon had to be evacuated from his besieged home and whisked away to a safe location. While his resignation was widely welcomed, President Gotabaya Rajapaksa's refusal to walk away infuriated anti-government protesters and added fuel to the fire. Although he offered some concessions and appointed veteran politician Ranil Wickremesinghe as the new premier, protesters in the Buddhist-majority country see his exit important for the country's economic recovery.
Mr. President and also Prime Minister and also members of Parliament, please step down and stop this violence. Don't disturb us, don't disturb people, because people are suffering. You all are playing the game. You all are playing the game. So we want to say, please step down and leave us alone.
The new Prime Minister has invited the opposition to form a unity government, but they have made it conditional on President Rajapaksa's resignation. Without a stable government in place, observers believe it will be difficult for Sri Lanka to negotiate a loan with the International Monetary Fund. The efforts to seek financial help from neighboring India and China will also be hampered amid a political crisis in the country.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Shiran Ilamperuma, an independent journalist and researcher. Welcome to the program, sir. Now, the small island nation of Sri Lanka is embroiled in its worst economic crisis, which has led to violent protests. Do you think it was inevitable given the economic mismanagement by successive governments?
Yeah, first of all, thanks for having me on your show and on your channel. As you said, it has been successive policy missteps by governments since Sri Lanka achieved independence from the British in 1948 that has led us to this point. There are structural weaknesses in the Sri Lankan economy, being basically since the time of colonialism, a plantation economy, an export-oriented plantation economy. Since the 1940s and 50s, we've been relying on exports of agricultural raw materials like tea, rubber, and coconut. And you know, obviously, this is not enough to sustain a nation that imports manufacturers from other countries, and this leads to constant trade deficits and pressure on the currency, which leads to devaluation and inflation. It's a vicious cycle that only industrialization, and especially, you know, at some point, export-oriented industrialization can solve. And no government has been able to implement this with a proper vision and maintain it for a long enough time. I think the current crisis in many ways exposes the Sri Lankan economy for what it has always been, right? In 1977, when the Sri Lankan economy was liberalized and opened up and you know, connected more deeply with the global economy, we were not able to produce enough, to export enough to justify our imports. And that balance, it was basically met through a very superficial consumption-oriented service sector, predominantly tourism. And at the same time, we were exporting our labor to the Gulf countries in the Middle East. And the remittances from those workers was what we used, along with tourism revenue, to balance out the trade deficit. I think what the COVID-19 pandemic and now the war in Ukraine have done is basically strip Sri Lanka from those two crutches, and it exposes the real economy, the real state of the economy.
Now let's talk about the Rajapaksas. The family has been accused of fanning the decades-old ethnic conflict in Sri Lanka by leading a brutal war against LTTE, repressing minority Tamils and Muslims. How do you see their fall from grace?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. I think, of course, the narrative of the Rajapaksas vis-a-vis the minorities and the civil war, that's very well known internationally, and it's part of the one sort of narrative that is allowed in Western media. It's not that this is entirely a false narrative. Of course, there's truth in it. Of course, there is a degree of ethnic chauvinism embedded in the Rajapaksa political project. But you know, one thing I just want to clarify is that this sort of negates the actual electoral base of the Rajapaksa family, which is in the south and in the rural regions. And if you actually go to these parts of Sri Lanka in the deep south and in very rural, unindustrialized areas where people depend on paddy farming, you know, smallholder agriculture, fisheries, you know, you will find that ethnic chauvinism doesn't really sell because these people have real issues, right? What makes them gravitate towards the Rajapaksas is the sort of economic incentives. Basically, the Rajapaksas coming from a nominally center-left nationalist background means that they respond to the rural electorate by giving them, you know, bare minimum, you know, agricultural subsidies, for example, subsidized fuel, subsidized fertilizer, and protection for domestic industries. So the electoral base of the Rajapaksas, despite being of the majority community, is dependent more on these economic relationships. The chauvinism and the racial dynamics, they feature more heavily in the urban sectors, actually, in places like Colombo, where most of the chauvinistic politicians are elected from Colombo. And because that's where the economic competition between rural to urban migrants and minorities in the trading sector is most intense.
Mr. Ilan Pramo, how important is a stable and united government in Colombo for the country to recover from the economic meltdown and political crisis? And do you think President Rajapaksa's resignation is a panacea?
I think a stable government is very much a necessity and a precondition to bring some semblance of normalcy. I think at this point, every political party in the country has to come together on some sort of common minimum program that will prioritize, first of all, providing essentials to the Sri Lanka people, you know, petrol, gas, food, all of those things, you know, electricity, so that the real economy can function. There also needs to be a stable government to negotiate with the IMF, to negotiate with our bilateral partners for bridge financing, and to eventually start negotiations on restructuring our external debt. In terms of the resignation of the president, that is a strong demand that comes from a lot of the protesters in Colombo, and I think a significant amount of people in rural areas would agree with it. I personally don't see that as a panacea, because what it would do is create a power vacuum, and it's not clear from the protesters on the ground who the alternative is, because there has yet to be a leader to sort of step up and be willing to fill that vacuum.
Mr. Ilan Pramo, thank you for being on the program. Glad to have you with us. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
A John Hopkins economist, Steve Hank, refers to soaring food prices and violent protests in Sri Lanka and says protesters have burnt down the homes of 38 politicians as the country plunges into further chaos. Jairam Ramesh, former Indian minister and lawmaker, says the roots of Sri Lanka's crisis lie not just in short-term economics, but more in linguistic, religious and cultural majoritarianism over the past decades. Political commentator and author Ashok Swain points to Rajapaksa's family's appeasement of the majority ethnic community and hate politics against Tamil Hindus and Muslims, saying the economic disaster has brought Buddhist monks to the streets.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
India and Japan, the two regional stalwarts, mark 70 years of their diplomatic relations this year. The partnership between them has steadily progressed over the years, especially after the two countries became special strategic and global partners in 2015. Japan's role as a shaper of India's regional engagement and broader global outlook has been significant. Now let's take a look at what in particular has bolstered their strategically driven relationship in their close synergy in the Indo-Pacific region and opposition to China's rise.
The Japanese envoy to India recently boasted that the relationship between the two countries is at its strongest point in history, with New Delhi being a strategic and global partner of Tokyo. Regional observers contend that the two countries as aspiring global powers are perfectly positioned to bring a non-Western perspective to discourse on the emerging global order. Japanese Premier Fumio Kishida's visit to India in March 2022 was significant for multiple reasons. While bilateral agreements signed during the visit will see $42 billion in Japanese investments in India, the visit also reaffirmed Japan's role in shaping India's regional and international engagement. Tokyo has played a key role in India's Look East policy by backing its membership in regional forums such as the East Asia Summit and investing in infrastructure connecting India and East Asia. The partnership between India and Japan has been primarily driven by their aversion to a Sino-centric regional and global order, which also prompted them to join the Quad. While their collaboration had so far focused on the Indo-Pacific region, it is now slowly extending beyond that. This was reflected in the joint statement issued by the two sides during PM Kishida's India visit, emphasizing a special strategic and global partnership. But disagreements remain, especially on the Ukraine war, where they find each other on opposite sides. Quad, by the way, stands for the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue, which is a strategic security dialogue between Australia, India, Japan, and the United States that is maintained by talks between member countries.
India and Japan have traditionally exercised strategic self-restraint in their respective foreign policies, mainly due to Japan's so-called Pacific Constitution and India's non-alignment. Both have for long shied away from asserting themselves on the big stage. But this is changing now. With rapidly changing regional and global dynamics, both countries have begun to develop more proactive foreign policies. On the Ukraine conflict, both have adopted strong but contrasting positions. And on China, the two countries have taken calculated risks.
A series of border skirmishes with China in recent years has prompted India to slowly abandon its adherence to the overarching principle of non-alignment and leapfrog into the Western bloc and its informal groupings like Quad. New Delhi has in particular shown great enthusiasm in forging closer ties with countries that don't see themselves as allies of China. Japan, on the other hand, has moved to recalibrate its positions on regional and global affairs in a departure from the country's pacifist foreign policies. Both countries, however, see China's phenomenal rise differently and have framed their responses accordingly. India's relationship with China is shaped by a long-standing power differential rooted in India's defeat in the 1962 war. The recent deadly clashes in the Ladakh region have only accentuated those fault lines. Japan's partnership has been shaped by its age-old cultural and historical ties with China, but that has not deterred it from conducting war games with the US in case of the event of a conflict with China over Taiwan. On Ukraine, both states have different postures. Japan has followed its allies, the United States and Australia, in condemning Russia's military operation and endorsing international economic sanctions against Russia. On the other hand, India has defied its Quad partner states and taken a neutral position while continuing to buy discounted Russian oil.
Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by Dr. Satoru Nagao, an expert on India's military strategy and the Japan-US-India Security Cooperation. Welcome to the program, Dr. Nagao. Now, let's begin with India and Japan's 70 years of diplomatic relations. Can you tell us how far have the two regional heavyweights come to become special strategic and global partners?
Okay, the last 70 years, the relation has moved. Progressed very much. But when our relation has progressed? Indeed, the last 20 years, our relation has progressed, especially after especially after since 2000, the relation has progressed a lot. So before the 2000 and after the 2000, completely different. Now we are the strategic partner, but before it, despite that there was no problem between two countries, we are not strategic partner. So now is a good time, best time for India and Japan relations.
Dr. Nagao, how do you assess Japan's role as a shaper of India's regional engagement and broader global outlook, especially the role it has played in India's Look East policy?
Japan focusing on the Indo-Pacific instead of Asia-Pacific, Japan focusing on Quad instead of just the U.S. circle, U.S., Japan, Australia. Why? Why? Because Japan started focusing on India. But why Japan focusing on India? The reason is China. China is dominating the big region, both sides, the Pacific side and the Indian Ocean side. And Japan need to deal with this situation. For India, situation is same. India starts a look east policy in 1990s. Why? Because India tried to find a new chance to develop the cooperation with the east side is a new chance. It's a Southeast Asia or Japan as located east side of India. But at the same time, the new threat is rising, which is China. Traditional threat, but after the Cold War, China is rising very fast, and China is a big threat for India too. So for Japan, China is a threat. For India, China is a threat. Now, India and Japan should cooperate. That's why the Indo-Pacific vision, the Japan's vision, and look east policy, India's policy, combined, share the same interests.
Dr. Nagao, the partnership between New Delhi and Tokyo has been mainly driven by their antipathy to Sino-centric regional and global order. So how have the two countries framed their responses to China's rise?
When you are a Chinese leader to defend China from other threat, what should you do? In this case, they need to decide to share of the China's military budget against Japan, against India, against others. If India and Japan cooperate each other, China need to divide their defense budget against India, against Japan. In this case, it is more easy for India and Japan to maintain military balance with China. And this is very important because what happened in the South China Sea indicate one pattern of China's territory expansion. When France withdrew from Indochina, China occupied half of the Paracel Island. When US withdrew from Vietnam, China occupied another half of the Paracel Island. When the Soviet Union reduced the troops, number of troops in Vietnam, China occupied the Spratly Island. When US troops withdrew from Philippines, China occupied Mischief Reef. Every time when the military balance has changed and when there is a power vacuum, China steals it. If so, maintaining military balance is most important way to deter China. If India and Japan cooperate with other US, Australia cooperate, China need to divide their defense budget multi-direction. In this case, it is more easy to maintain military balance. That's why India and Japan share the same interest.
On that note, I would like to thank Dr. Nagao from Japan for his precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Mahesh Puttapaka, a journalist based in India, cites a newspaper article to assert that if partnership between India and Japan is to enhance regional security and prosperity in the Indo-Pacific, the time is now. Journalist and editor Benjamin Norton says the U.S. seeks to bring right-wing governments in India, Japan, and Australia together in a Quad alliance to wage war on their common foe, China.
And that was our episode about the simmering economic and political crisis gripping Sri Lanka and the steady progress in India-Japan relations amid rapidly changing global order. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
An unprecedented trove of leaked IRS data shows who reported the most income in America from 2013 to 2018, as well as their tax rates, revealing that the very richest pay lower rates than the merely rich. Stay with us for an article in this regard, published in ProPublica under the heading America's Top 15 Earners and What They Reveal About U.S. Tax System. Here's more. Thanks to an analysis of its unprecedented trove of IRS data, ProPublica is revealing the 15 people who reported the most U.S. income under taxes from 2013 to 2018, along with data for the rest of the top 400. The analysis also shows how much they paid in federal income taxes, and it demonstrates how the American tax system, which theoretically makes the highest earners pay the highest income tax rates, fails to do so for the people at the very top of the income pyramid. The top 400 earners pay noticeably lower tax rates than the merely rich, and if you include payroll taxes, a married couple making $200,000 a year could end up paying higher tax rates than a person making $200 million a year. Scan the names on the list of the top 15 income earners and you're certain to recognize several names, or at least the names of the companies they founded. Bill Gates hasn't been involved in the day-to-day operations of Microsoft for over a decade, yet he still earned the most during the years experts studied, reporting an average yearly income of $2.85 billion and an effective federal income tax rate of 18.4%. Steve Ballmer, his former colleague, is also a well-known public figure, both for his time as Microsoft CEO and his current ownership of the Los Angeles Clippers NBA team. Ballmer's average annual reported income of $1.5 billion landed him in the 10th spot on the list, and his effective federal income tax rate was 14.1%. The other side of the PC Mac Wars is represented by Lauren Powell Jobs, widow of Apple founder Steve Jobs. Her average reported income of $1.57 billion ranked fifth highest. She paid an effective tax rate of 14.8%. ProPublica sought comments from everyone mentioned in this article. Nobody disputed the numbers cited here. Unless otherwise noted, representatives for people named in this article either declined to comment on the record, or did not respond to requests for comment. Another well-known billionaire sits just below Gates on the list, media and tech mogul and former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. With an average reported income of just over $2 billion, paid an effective income tax rate of 4.1%, by far the lowest rate among the top 15. The presence of Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, either the first or second wealthiest person in America, depending on the day, won't shock most people. But Bezos' annual reported income during these years of $832 million put him only at number 15. He paid an effective tax rate of 23.2%. As previously reported, Bezos had so little income in a couple of recent years that he was able to pay $0 in federal income taxes in those periods. Tech billionaires dominate the top 15, but hedge fund managers account for a full third of the names on this list, and some of their incomes were just as huge. Most of them paid relatively high effective tax rates, especially compared to most of the tech sector representatives. Hedge fund managers often make their money through short-term trades, which are taxed at a much higher rate than when tech titans cash in on long-term investments. The highest earning hedge funder is Ken Griffin, founder of Chicago-based firm Citadel. From 2013 to 2018, he reported an average income of nearly $1.7 billion, putting him fourth on the list. Griffin paid a tax rate of 29.2% during these years. Israel Englander, co-founder of Millennium Management, paid at a 30.8% rate, while the co-founders of two Sigma investments, David Siegel and John Overdeck, paid tax rates of 31.6% and 34.2% respectively. Some of this variation in rates reflects how people structure their businesses under tax law. Income earned by publicly traded corporations is taxed at the company level. When it's passed on to big shareholders, such as tech billionaires, it can come in the form of dividends, which are taxed at lower rates than ordinary income. By contrast, the income from some manufacturing companies and hedge funds flows directly to company owners, who pay taxes on it, resulting in higher effective tax rates on average. Lists of the world's wealthiest individuals are always heavily populated by heirs, ranging from descendants of old money to scions of more recently minted fortunes. Dozens of heirs made ProPublica's list of 400 biggest income earners. Descendants and relatives of Sam Walton, founder of Walmart, claim 11 spots. The DeVos family, heirs to the Amway fortune, also have multiple members in the top 400. Perhaps the best known is Betsy DeVos, who served as U.S. Secretary of Education during the Donald Trump administration. With a reported annual income of $112 million, Betsy DeVos was the 389th higher earner in this period. Much like the tech titans who top the list, most of these heirs get their income from dividends or long-term investments, which are taxed at a low rate. Their effective tax rates ranged from as low as 10.6% for Betsy DeVos to a high of 23% paid by Walmart heir Tom Walton. Another key way that some top earners reduced their tax liability was to claim significant deductions, often in the form of large charitable contributions. This is particularly true for wealthy investors who are able to make their donations with shares of a stock. Thanks to a generous provision of tax code, they can then deduct the full value of the stock at its current price without having to first sell it and pay capital gains tax. Michael Bloomberg achieved a tax rate of 4.1% from 2013 to 2018 by taking annual deductions of more than $1 billion, mostly through charitable contributions. From 2013 to 2017, he also wrote off an average of $400 million each year from what he paid in state and local taxes. The 2018 tax overhaul limited that deduction to $10,000, but also introduced a huge new deduction for pass-through companies that Bloomberg benefited from.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
On Thursday, leaders of Sweden and Finland, two European nations that opted for neutrality for years, flanked U.S. President Joe Biden while he threw his support behind their bid to join the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, at the White House.
And today I'm proud to assure them that they have the full, total, complete backing of the United States of America. Today, my administration is submitting to the United States Congress reports on NATO accession for both countries so the Senate can efficiently and quickly move on advising and consenting to the treaty.
I don't think those nations really ought to be scared of Russia. That would be really stupid if they were. Maybe they are that foolish and believe the narrative going on. I think it's more there's a power play. I mean, you look at the sanctions, that's where you really see the intent. And President Biden said this in Poland. He said, we intend that Russia's economy will be half of what it was over years. So that reveals he's planning to continue this for years. Zelensky, even if he were inclined to negotiate, will not be allowed to do it. And I think there's an intent to force governments to pick sides.
The move comes amid objections by Turkey, a NATO ally, and warnings by Russia. Ankara opposes Finland's and Sweden's accession to the military alliance, citing their longtime support for groups Turkey deems terrorists. Moscow, however, has warned of retaliation if Finland, a country that shares a 1,340-kilometer-long border with Russia, joins NATO. Russia's Deputy UN Representative Dmitry Polyansky went so far as to say that the two nations could turn into potential targets for Russia if they become NATO members. Finland and Sweden say they decided to join the NATO and reverse decades of military non-alignment after Russia attacked Ukraine. But Russia considers NATO's eastward expansion a threat to its national security. The issue was a critical reason Russian officials say pushed Moscow to launch its military operation in Ukraine in February. As the war between Ukraine and Russia entered its fourth month, the U.S. Senate passed a $40 billion bill to provide assistance to Ukraine. 86 senators voted for the bill, while 11 others, all Republicans, voted against it, citing its high price tag and the fact that it might not be offset. The bill earmarks $6 billion for arms to be purchased from contractors and sent to Ukraine. It also increases the presidential drawdown capacity from the $5 billion the Biden administration had originally requested to $11 billion. The drawdown capacity allows the president to send away arms and military equipment directly from U.S. stocks at times of emergency.
It used to be the case when you had votes for sanctions against Russia, it would only be two senators voting against. So I think the revolt against this policy is growing. And I can tell you from the campaigning I've been doing and speaking with hundreds of American voters, Americans do not want this war. They don't support spending all this money on weapons. They may not have a completely elevated view of it, but their inclination is to say, we are suffering here. We're paying $1 million a gallon for gasoline. We're running out of baby formula. Why are we doing this? And I want that to be known around the world that the American people are not represented by the policies of this administration.
The war and the subsequent sanctions on Russia have sent shockwaves across the globe, threatening the most vulnerable economies in the world that have yet to recover from the economic fallout of the COVID-19 pandemic. It's also creating a new global crisis, food shortages.
This is not just about Ukraine. This is about the poorest of the poor around the world who are on the brink of starvation as we speak.
The whole world, including the U.S. and its allies, is paying the price for the war and its ensuing events. The situation would only get worse if the conflict continues indefinitely. The economic, political, and military pressures against Moscow don't seem to contribute to any compromise from the Russian side. The U.S. has expressed its opposition to a prolonged war, but actions speak louder than words.
Tensions between Russia and Israel appear to be on the rise. Israeli media reports say Russian forces have opened fire on Israeli jets with advanced S-300 anti-aircraft missiles. The missiles were fired at Israeli warplanes after they attacked targets in northwestern Syria. The move is seen as a sign of significant shift in Moscow's attitude toward Israel. The unprecedented incident is said to have occurred on Friday night when Israeli jets targeted an area near the city of Masyaf, which killed several people. Israel's airstrikes on targets in Syria are countered by the country's anti-aircraft missile batteries. But this time, however, the S-300 batteries also opened fire as the jets were departing the area.
It is the case that these missiles, the S-300 battery, is operated by Russian military personnel, and that they would not have fired without permission from senior commanders. Okay, this is a break in the normal procedure.
Syria's S-300 batteries are operated by Russian military and cannot be fired without their approval. Israeli media reports claim the S-300 radar did not manage to lock onto the Israeli jets and thus did not present a serious threat to the fighter jets. But this would mark the first use of the S-300s against the Israeli warplanes over Syria. It's not clear whether the S-300 missile fire was a one-time event or if it was a Russian signal to Israel that it was changing its policy.
So this was the first use of it, and it was known to be done by Russian military personnel at Russian military command. But it also, they did not lock the radar on the planes. So the planes were never in danger. It's unclear from the reports whether they couldn't lock the radar on the planes or whether they just didn't lock them and just wanted to throw these missiles up there as a kind of signal and a warning to Israel that, you know, we may change our policy and we may take down some planes.
The development comes amid deteriorating relations between Tel Aviv and Moscow over Ukraine. Israel has backed Ukraine after the war began. Tel Aviv's stance has angered Russia. Russia's latest move against Israel would be a worrying development for Israel.
And that has to do, of course, with the whole reverberations of what's going on with Ukraine. And, you know, the Russians are realizing that and starting to act much more militantly, in the sense that they understand this is now a war for the future of a lot of things.
The Tel Aviv regime has repeatedly targeted the positions of the Syrian army and its allies, but has rarely acknowledged or discussed such operations. The aerial bombardment intensified in scale and frequency after 2011, when the Arab country found itself in the grip of foreign-backed militancy and terrorism.
Oh, it will continue. No question about it. Look, it's not going to even think about stopping until a plane goes down. If S-300s or some other effective anti-aircraft defense takes down Israeli planes, then there'll be a problem. So the Russians have signaled something here, and they didn't take down a plane. And until and unless they do, Israel's not going to change its policy on that at all. And even if they do, that would cause a problem for Israel, and they would have to think twice about it.
Damascus says Tel Aviv carries out attacks on the Arab country to aid terrorist groups against the Syrian army. It has repeatedly complained to the United Nations, calling the aggression a blatant violation of the country's sovereignty and international law. The development comes after warmongering rhetoric of Israeli officials against Iran and its allies. Just recently, Israel's Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, said Tel Aviv would prevent Iran from transferring advanced capabilities to its allies in the region. But Iran has dismissed the threats, saying it's determined to help the resistance axis stand up against Israel's aggressive moves in the region.
Former U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has visited Albania. Officially, the trip was meant to celebrate the centenary of U.S.-Albania diplomatic relations. But Pompeo's stance against Iran manifested itself after he went to the camp of a notorious terrorist cult there. Pompeo held a meeting with the leaders of the Mujahideen-e Khalq, or MKO, terrorist cult. Encouraged by the presence of terrorists there, Pompeo repeated his anti-Iran rant, expressing his long, unfulfilled wish to see the Islamic Republic overthrown. The former CIA chief said that under the leadership of infamous Maryam Rajavi, the MKO has been laying the groundwork for what he called a, quote, free, sovereign, democratic republic of Iran.
The recent visit of Mike Pompeo to Albania is in a way a revitalization of the old connections that Mike Pompeo has with Israeli Mossad and the Iranian Mujahideens, who are terrorists.
Pompeo is not part of the current U.S. administration, but his rhetoric and deeds indeed reflect the deep-seated animosity of the U.S. establishment towards Iran and its government. During his tenure as the U.S. Secretary of State between 2018 and 2021 in the Trump administration, Pompeo and other belligerent politicians around him, most notably former National Security Advisor John Bolton, expressed an open secret regarding Washington's stance towards MKO terrorist cult. Pompeo and his team became the MKO sponsors in his delusional attempt to overthrow the Islamic Republic. Back then, the regime in Washington left no stone unturned to topple Iran, but failed miserably in their hysteric anti-Iran drive.
Pompeo was paid probably more than $150,000 for his visit to the Mujahideen camp.
Mujahideen-e Khalq is a terrorist cult which is now based at a camp in Albania. The MKO regularly hosts big events in which top American and European officials make speeches in support of the group.
They run a paramilitary camp in the town of Manza in the region of Durrës in Albania. From Manza, the Mujahideens, they carry hostile and terrorist activities against Iran, but even against political Islam in general.
Former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton, former U.S. Senator Joe Lieberman, and former director of Saudi Arabia's intelligence agency, Turki bin Faisal Al Saud, are amongst the top officials that have attended the group's events. The terrorist cult has been accused of being involved in various criminal activities in Europe, including human trafficking, with possible links to the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group. The MKO was formally designated as a terrorist group around the world, but the United States and the Europeans delisted it in recent years amid growing strains in ties with Tehran. The terrorist group also fought alongside Iraqi forces in the former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein's war on Iran in the 1980s. Prior to that, it killed thousands of ordinary Iranians and officials, the number said to be in the tens of thousands. Support for anti-Iran terrorist groups in the US and Europe has remarkably grown in the Western countries, with many Western spy agencies actively involved in aiding and arming them.
Well, the U.S. government has a long history of cooperating with terrorist organizations. Nowadays, we have many countries in the Middle East who complain from the U.S. support for different terrorist groups.
The Islamic Republic has already warned Europeans that their support for the MKO will be costly for them. Tehran has condemned the hosting of the group by Albania and is delisting by the U.S. and Europe.
On Saturday, a gunman attacked a supermarket in Buffalo, New York, killing 10 people and injuring three others. Most of the victims were African American, making the attack one of the deadliest racially charged mass shootings in the United States' recent history. According to the police, the detained suspect, identified as 18-year-old Peyton Gendron, drove over 200 miles to carry out the attack. The law enforcement also said they were reviewing a 180-page document published online detailing the gunman's motivations. In the so-called manifesto, the author describes himself as a white supremacist concerned about, quote, the dwindling white population. The document also says that he chose the area for the attack as its zip code has a large black population, which was within the driving distance of where he lived.
The inability of the unsustainability of neoliberal capitalism. So there's less resources, there's scarcity, there's a job market is being affected. Everyone is affected by that, but their interpretation of what the problem is different. And for white extremists, white supremacist extremists, they blame immigrants, they blame black people, they blame. And so you're seeing these ideologies that are emerging, or mentalities, or not emerging. They've always existed, but they're responding to the intensification of the logical conclusions of neoliberalism and neoliberal capitalism, austerity, joblessness, you know, privatization, all of that.
The police are investigating the attack as a hate crime, as an act of racially motivated violent extremism. The teenager faces first-degree murder, a charge he has pleaded not guilty to. Among the victims were a father who was buying a birthday cake for his three-year-old son, and Catherine Massey, a 72-year-old woman who was known for her civil rights advocacy. The tragic irony is that almost a year ago, she had written a letter to a local newspaper calling for stricter gun control measures. The Buffalo mass shooter managed to live stream his attack on a popular streaming service using camera gear mounted on his military helmet. Although the feed was taken down soon after it began, the issue reignited criticisms about the moderation of social media platforms. It bore striking similarities with the 2019 terrorist attack on two mosques in the city of Christchurch in New Zealand that killed 51 people. That attack was also streamed live on social media. The incident in Buffalo is considered the deadliest mass shooting in the U.S. so far this year. but some 200 other mass shootings were carried out since the beginning of January. Unofficial data suggests that over 320 people are shot in the U.S. every day. A recent report by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention showed that gun violence in the country rose dramatically in 2020, with homicides involving firearms surging by 35%, the highest level in 25 years.